Hey, deserving listeners, today we have a very special guest with us, Dr. Kirk Snyder. I've been reading his various publications since I entered the field in the mid-90s. He has published various books and journal articles over the years, very prolific writer. He, if you don't know, he's a highly renowned person, figure in the field of existential therapy and psychology, but also in the field in general. I would be surprised if anyone being trained as a therapist in the last 20, 30 years doesn't know about Dr. Kirk Snyder. Also, in my opinion, he has a brilliant mind, a very intelligent individual, very interesting person. And also, I find the stuff that I know about Dr. Kirk, I've never met him before until today, which I'm quite honored. But I also find you, Dr. Kirk Snyder, to be a kind soul as well. I could see you being a natural therapist for people. So welcome to the podcast, Dr. Kirk Snyder.
Thank you so much, Kirk. Dr. Honda. I'm very honored to be here with you.
It's great to meet another Kirk. You know, it's not often that I get to meet other Kirks.
This is true. This is very true. Yeah, it's a special moment.
Okay, so let's get into your book, which I have a copy here. Your newest book. Have you published, what, like 30 books in your life?
Not quite. No. More like 14.
14, okay. It's a very easy read. If you don't know much about existential therapy, it will confuse you kind of, but there's a lot, and there's enough in here that's easy enough for people to understand. It's broken up into short chapters. I like books that are like that. It makes it easy to read. So I like that format. But I want to get into some of the things that you talk about in this book. The first thing I want to talk about, often when people talk about existential therapy or your work, they will summarize it in this very reductive way. There will be this extremely brief bullet point list of, like, you know, anxiety and responsibility and, you know, these kinds of things, not only of your work, but of existential therapists in general, psychologists in general. So I'm really looking forward to talking with you because I've always wanted to know, how does this work in the mind of Dr. Kirk Snyder, and how does it work in the real life when you're working with clients? So I want to ask you some specific questions. The first one is, you have a chapter on from anxiety to awe, trying to help people moving from anxiety to awe. Can you explain that idea?
Well, it has a lot to do with my own journey with anxiety, but also those I've observed in clients and just other folks out there. Well, anxiety, as I understand it, is really fear of the unknown. And I think that begins right at the beginning, as soon as we're ejected from the womb. And we come into all these strange people and places and things that hit us. And they're radically unknown. We have no background, no equipment, really, to deal with it, or very little. And so I think that, as Otto Rank put it, that's really the beginning and maybe the source of all future anxiety and trauma, is that sense of sort of groundlessness and helplessness that we feel when we come out of the womb. And the question is, how well do our caretakers and the culture around us help us to work with that otherness, you know, that radical difference that we encounter in ourselves and in other people and places from the beginning? Do they come at it with a great deal of fear and trepidation themselves, which can just add to our own fears of that which is other and different? And by the way, I think that is basis in many ways for our prejudices and bigotries as well. Or do they come at us in a more holding environment, if you will, as the analyst Winnicott talked beautifully about, you know, the capacity to help us begin to internalize more of a centeredness with all those strange things that we're encountering, and to see that, well, yes, they're terrifying and overwhelming, all these strange things. But if we can feel safe enough from our caretakers and from the culture around us to feel like we can stay with them, we can be present to this peril, we may begin to see some other things that we didn't see at the beginning. We may start to become curious about all these unusual things that hit us, we may start to be intrigued because we feel safe enough to pause, to look over, you know, the parent who catches us, you know, when we're coming right out of the womb and from wherever we're coming from cosmically. We maybe begin to study their face, start to become interested in our environment, what's around us, the lights, the colors. And I think the more that we can do this, and some interesting studies have really affirmed this, the more we can shift from a place of basically terror and paralysis to gradual incremental curiosity, wonder, and maybe even fascination with what's around us. And that's what I mean by the sense of awe. I would capture the sense of awe by defining it as the sense of humility and wonder, capacity to experience our smallness and fragility in the world, but also at the same time have access to being able to take risks, to venture out, to inquire. And so that's the wonder part. Basically, it's developing a sense of adventure toward living. Mm. And it's a wonderful attitude if one can develop it. But we need inner freedom to do that.
Yeah. So to tell you how I metabolize what you're saying and in reading your book, you seem to be much more interested today, which makes sense, on the political landscape and the political divide, people that are at odds with each other, not only in our country, but in other areas of the world. And when you talk about, when your response reminds me of some of the writing you have in this book around that, that from birth, as Otto Rank identified over 100 years ago-ish, as soon as you enter into the world, you're faced with a lot of uncertainty, a lot of other things that are not of us. We become differentiated suddenly and realize there's all these outside things that are almost universally terrifying, and we have to struggle with that. And then, as you say, parents, caregivers, culture, how do they help us to provide a holding environment for us to cope with that, to feel the way that the words I would say in attachment language is to feel secure enough and safe enough to just feel safe, to feel secure, to feel like you're not in danger. Someone's taking care of you. Your culture's taking care of you. Your caregivers are taking care of you. And from that, safety, you're able to curious about the world. You can move away from the secure base with security. You know that you can go back to your secure base and you can begin to just be open and just be curious and also appreciate the other instead of being in that constant state of fear, which can result in paralyzation and or defensiveness, right? Of, well, I have to attack the other. I have to eliminate the other and I have to straw man the other and vilify the other. And that's what you write about in your book. And that's what we see in our society today. So that's what I'm hearing when I hear you talk about from anxiety to awe.
That's very well put. Yes. I mean, the only thing I would add there is that I think the analysts are onto something with this idea of internalization, that we internalize that holding environment that we hopefully can get from our caretakers. And that becomes part of the way we relate to ourselves. So we end up relating to ourselves in a more supportive, understanding, present way, rather than just scrambling or going to extremes, what I'd call the polarized mind, which is the fixation on a single point of view to the utter exclusion of competing points of view. And I think that comes directly out of a problem with encountering this otherness that we're talking about, these differences.
How do we help our current society to change from anxiety to awe?
Well, I would say that there's a long-term response to that question, and there's a shorter-term response. The longer term is that we really need to fortify the way that we engage in child rearing and to create a culture and a kind of ethic that promotes greater contact between parents and children, a more substantive contact. I mean, we are so distracted today. We've always been distracted, or for a very long time, by having to put bread on the table. Parents have been distracted by just having to make money. But now that is true for many people, but also it's compounded by the resort to devices, to our smartphones, to our instant communications. And we get caught up in, you know, surfing and net surfing and that sort of thing. So parents have a lot of challenges with distractions. And I think it makes it that much harder to provide the kind of presence, the quality of holding that I'm talking about. But I absolutely feel that we need to rework that and come to a place where we recognize how vital it is to be able to revel in our children's experience, to be able to clear one's own mind and be whole being as much as possible, to really try to tune in to what the child needs, wants, is struggling with, to engage with them in a very responsive way. I mean, you know about these experiments, Kirk, I imagine, called the still face experiment, where they've shown as early as a couple hours old, when the child's a couple hours old, if the parent, it's often been the mother's, but it could be the father, if the parent goes blank, shows a poker face to the child, that child very quickly deteriorates. It's like they fall off an emotional cliff. Because again, it brings them back to this place of helplessness and groundlessness that I think that they're overwhelmed by. So if that child rearing can really value and see the necessity of being more present to the child, of engaging in conversation with the child, helping the child to, as the child is able to understand and unpack, what they're struggling with, or what they're struck by, what they're delighted by. The parent can be responsive and mirroring for the child in about those things. I think that's all to the good in terms of helping to shift our culture more toward a presence-centered way of being with each other and less fear-based. Hopefully, that would mean less prejudice, bigotry, and capacity to be with the otherness in ourselves, because we also, as we grow, we find out all kinds of things that are strange and new to ourselves, too. And if we're coming from a fear-based place, as opposed to a more present-centered place, we're going to be jumping out of our skin, or we're going to be polarized, we're going to be fixed on something certain, whether that's an ideology or maybe another person that we, you know, we aggrandize so that we can avoid dealing with that strangeness in ourselves and with others. So that's the longer term answer. And I think that this sense of awe relates to that, creating conditions where people can feel humility, their smallness, their vulnerability, as well as their boldness and capacity to venture out. Not only in child rearing, but hopefully more and more in the work setting, that we can provide conditions for workers to explore, let's say, the meaning and purpose of their work, and how that can be a place where they can be more fully present to their work and to their communities as well. In our spiritual and religious places as well, this can be brought in. And I think in our governmental and deliberative settings, and we can get to that in a moment. I've been a part of this conflict mediation group, Braver Angels, but now I'm focused more on partly an offshoot of that I call the Experiential Democracy Dialogue, where I bring people together of contrasting backgrounds for humanizing conversations. So I think this could be brought into a deliberative setting as well. But to give you a more short answer on that, I think it's extremely helpful if we can make what I've called emotionally restorative relationships more accessible and affordable to people. I'm talking about mentorships, mentoring for kids in school, and also potential for longer-term in-depth psychotherapy, especially for our youth in underserved areas, especially. I think we need something on the equivalent of a Peace Corps or a Works Progress Administration program to bring mental health professionals together, rally us to provide more of these kinds of emotionally restorative relationships, make them available, not impose them on people, make them available in communities and in more private settings, you know, with families or especially youth who are struggling, because it's very hard for parents. That's part of it. And very hard in our quick fixed instant result culture to provide that. So that's a whole other area we could explore further. I have further ideas about that. I called for a national core of psychologists or a national core of mental health professionals to provide this kind of service, partly through volunteering a fraction of their week, let's say, to providing such services, and also government funding and private funding. But you need somebody to rally people to the cause around this. I think also just providing people with or encouraging people to seek out not only psychotherapy, substantive therapy, but maybe people in their neighborhood or in their schools who can be mentors, who can be helpful witnesses, as the analyst Alice Miller put it. These people can be extremely important in helping to hold the difficulties that one is experiencing and being models for them for a more deliberative way to live, a more open and enriching way to live. Meditation could also be helpful, but people do need to do some work on this. I have some issues with the popular press at times, some of these self-help books that, you know, promise the moon right away. And I just think that something like the sense of awe toward living is a lifetime cultivation. And we got to step up as individuals in seeking it out and realizing the importance of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I want to talk about your facilitation of debate between people or understanding between disparate groups, traditionally disparate groups. You write about it in your book and you lay out the outline, if you will. Maybe it's the outline you follow with the folks you work with. It reminds me of Carl Rogers talked about this as well and put effort into this experiencing each other, listening to each other, putting aside one's assumptions, you know, phenomenological listening among groups of people that traditionally literally want to kill each other in war, in political fighting, in community. You're actually doing that work. I didn't know. It sounded like you were providing a prescription for that, you know, a guideline, but you're actually doing that work. What is that like when you actually bring these groups together?
Well, I've been working on this for the last several years. You know, it really depends on the group. Mainly, I've been working with mental health professionals who are struggling with the polarization in the country, ideological polarization, political polarization of their patients often, and how they're having conflicts with them around this.
So just a common would be a liberal clinician working with a conservative client.
Exactly. And I have a six-phase format, experiential democracy dialogue, where I take the therapist through the steps with a partner who is either genuinely, let's say, conservative, if the therapist is highly liberal, or attempts to embody how a conservative would respond, and in particular, how that therapist's patient is likely to respond. So that it takes some education by the therapist about the patient and the background of the patient so that the partner can emulate them as much as possible.
So are you saying that in these trainings or these meetings, you work with clinicians, the patients aren't there, the clients are not there, and there will be a role play played by a partner that will volunteer and say, I'll play your conservative client. And then you're trying to help the clinician to step into a place of awe as opposed to anxiety.
Yeah, well, I mean, to move toward a place of awe, let's put it that way, in place of the anxiety and the panic that often, you know, initially arises. But I've also worked with people in the community more generally. I did a facilitation that's on YouTube between a African-American activist and a white police officer, using basically this format, a different version. This is from a number of years ago. I've worked with genuine liberals and conservatives, some from the Braver Angels group. They work with liberals and conservatives in living room style dialogues. So I've applied this model to various settings. But the basic point is that trying to help people to move from the position of, again, this rigid, polarized stance, which is usually filled with stereotypes about the other, whether that's a liberal other or a conservative other or a racial other, et cetera, to a place of greater curiosity, openness, basically a place of greater understanding, a greater ability to learn about and understand the other versus come at the other with one's own knee-jerk reactions and stereotypes. So the approach, as I said, was six phases. I bring a lot of my own existential depth psychology background to it. I think that's where I'm a little more focused than the Braver Angels folks. There's a lot of crossover and similarity. But for example, before we even begin any dialogue about a particular issue, I invite the partners to visualize what it might be like just to sit with that person, knowing about their stance, you know, and what kind of thoughts, feelings, especially feelings, body sensations, images come up for you, maybe scenes come up for you from your past, as you just sit with that person. And you just take a couple of minutes to kind of immerse in that and see if you can watch it like you'd watch something floating down a river, rather than fixating on any one thing that comes up. See if you can watch it like a movie or a river and acknowledge, okay, this is here, and oh, that reaction's there, and that's there, and note all this that is bubbling up in you as you're sitting with this, you know, radically other person, quote unquote. And then I invite them to take a couple of minutes to, again, this is done in silence, and they could close their eyes, however they feel comfortable doing this. I invite them to take some time to see if they can clear a space for the human being that's before them, meaning a real person with a real story and real wounds and real struggles. And see if you can see that in the person, in their face, in their way of being, in what you might surmise about this person having had a life, and also honoring, to the degree you can, honor the fact, if you don't honor anything else about the person, honor the fact that they're willing to sit here and be present with you and engage. So that's the beginning. I suggest that they take some time to really take that in, take the whole phase in. And then again, before we even start in with issues, I will invite the partners to talk about what it was like for them to grow up, especially in regard to the issue at hand, whether that has to do with, you know, politics or culture or religion or race. Before they even get to, again, talking about it, how did their family system treat any of these hot button issues? You know, what culture did they grow up in regard to these issues? And have them elaborate that to each other. They both take turns doing that for, I think, about 5 minutes each. So again, they're learning about and attempting to understand the other versus imposing their view or having answers for the other. I should mention that all of this is preceded by a very strong emphasis on adhering to the ground rules. We found that vital. I think conflict mediation folks who deal especially with political and cultural contrasts have learned over the years that you really got to have some guardrails with these kind of conversations, because they can deteriorate so fast, just like I was talking about with the still face experiments with kids, because we have that primal terror in us about that other, how scary that is. So the guardrails, we provide that at the beginning, before any of the phases, and they have a lot to do with, first of all, doing everything you can to encounter the other from a place of curiosity, openness, and respect. Respect, if only for the fact that they're willing to engage with you. That's an important beginning. But that curiosity, see if you can come from a place of genuine curiosity. I've been filled with stereotypes most of my life, and now here's a chance to really find out much more about, where is this person coming from? I don't get it. I really want to try to get it. And then there's the points about, try to make I statements versus accusations toward the other as you get into the dialogue. Don't impose your views on the other. Avoid devaluing the other, et cetera. And even nonverbally, we recommend, avoiding rolling of the eyes, or the facial expressions that can convey contempt. Again, being as mindful as you can entering in. So that's important. So it is often helpful to have a third person there facilitating or mediating. Not necessary, but it can be helpful. So anyway, I covered the first two phases. The third is where you actually take a stance, and each partner has 5 minutes to elaborate on, without interruption, on their particular perspective on culture or politics, et cetera, so that the other can absorb it more. And then the other person takes a few moments to check in, basically to reflect back what they heard as mindfully and heartfully as possible. And this is a chance for greater empathy also. See if you can get in the shoes of that other person and reflect back, this is what I heard you saying and you struggling with, and et cetera. And then that original speaker has a chance to correct anything that's false or misleading in the reflection. And then they switch roles. And then, I don't know if you want me to go into the six phases, but I can summarize them quickly. Okay, and then just quickly, and this does take a lot more immersion and background if you're going to actually do it. But the fourth phase is the stereotypes exercise, which I borrowed directly from Braver Angels. I think it's brilliant in so many ways. But it's basically about the speaking partner identifying the stereotypes against them, like how people who are negative toward them stereotype them and lay that out for the witnessing partner. I'm seen this way, that way, and this way. Gun-toting, women-hating, whatever person, or bleeding heart liberal who is, aimless and disorganized, whatever. And then the speaking partner identifies the false and misleading aspects of the stereotype. So there's their chance to correct the record, to fill it in again with more of their humanness. And then the final piece is to identify any nuggets of truth to the stereotypes. That's often a very difficult one, especially for people who feel very polarized against each other. But it can be extremely helpful as a potential bridge building step with the partner, because it is humbling oneself and often, getting oneself off that high platform of self-righteousness and acknowledging, there's some flaws in my my way of thinking or living. So that's the stereotype exercise. They both do that. And then there's a fifth is the asking a question of your partner. And again, you try to ask a question from genuine curiosity rather than having an answer in the question or accusing person in the question. So I noticed you talked about, not having the government interfere with our lives. But I wonder, how does that work if you're sick and you don't have enough money, let's say? You know, but it has a lot to do with the way you ask the question too, you know, the energy you bring, your body, not just the words you use. And then finally, the discovery results phase. Basically, what did you discover from this, you know, 50-minute to an hour encounter with the other? What did you learn about the other? What did you learn about yourself with the other? Is there any potential for common ground? Or maybe even some mutual project or engagement? And to tell you frankly, Kirk, I mean, what I find in these dialogues, and I found this with Braver Angels as well, is that people don't necessarily, in fact, they often don't end up agreeing ideologically per se with each other. But what does happen and what has been extremely powerful for me, and I know others as well, is they feel like they can actually be friendly with this other person who before, you know, was the mortal enemy. And I think that's a major, major step, especially given a country that is basically at each other's throats.
Okay, let's take a break. And when we get back, let's continue. Late at night, as an exercise to fall asleep, I have various different mental exercises that I play around with. And one of which has been for years is to somehow have the authoritative power to bring these groups together, bring Putin and Zelensky together, bring Trump and I don't know who would be AOC together or something, and to have it be public broadcasted. Because as a couple therapist, I see this happen all the time. People come into my office and it's the same thing. We could replace stereotype with assumptions. We can replace cultural indoctrination with relational traumas, internalizations, and I help people, and we have to, it's hard, you know, and you have to start, and I have to facilitate it. If they just talk about it without me there, they'll spin out of control. So there's a lot of guardrails, like you say, and I have to embody that. I might even agree with one person over the other. I might feel like I'm more like one person, but I, you know, that's not going to help. I have to help both people. I have to challenge my own, you know, as I'm sure you do, Dr. Snyder. You have to challenge your own stereotypes because you've been indoctrinated into the cultural pocket that you're in, and you don't want to alienate the other. You don't want to make it seem like you're... So it's a very similar thing. And so when I watch couples go through this, it breaks my heart, but it pales in comparison to literally hundreds of thousands of people dying in a war currently in Europe right now, because what I interpret is fear. Putin is afraid. He's afraid of being invaded or made to bow down to the economic powerhouse of the West. I don't know what it is. He's afraid of something, or his people are afraid of something, people that are influencing on him. And I'm positive that if you gave me or you the power to force them, the people in power, to sit down and to actually not only have these conversations, but actually over time, you know, proof's in the pudding. It's like, okay, Putin, what do you need to see from Europe to make you feel less afraid? And Putin's, I'm not afraid. I'd be like, well, let's explore that, because you certainly look like you're afraid. You're not talking like you're afraid, but this is what people do when they're afraid. They get violent and they get protective and they start to lock in on a certain point of view and they start spreading propaganda. They start trying to get a bunch of power and influence over, you know, and take over the press and da da da. So, you know, And then you have these conversations. And I might even say, if I were you, I'd be afraid too. If I were in your shoes, this is how I would feel, because the history and you know, if we could just get Trump and AOC together, and while everyone's watching, and actually, but you and I know you get it, Dr. Snyder, but when I talk about this to people in my circle, they laugh their asses off. They're just like, are you fucking kidding? That's useless. Do you not understand? I mean, in my Seattle liberal circle, do you not understand that Trump is basically the devil and Putin is basically the devil? There's no dealing with these fascist Nazis. And I'm like, maybe, but we have to try. But we don't have the power. Dr. Snyder, you and I are just sitting here yammering into the ether, and they'll never listen. We've been, Carl Rogers talked about this back in the day. I'm sure there were people before him that talked about this, and they just keep, it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. Just, it just keeps getting worse. And the research shows it, the political divide gets worse and worse and worse. And it just seems to, I don't know. And then I just think, you know, when you break an arm, you go to the physician, right? When your marriage is falling apart, you come to a marriage family therapist. When you have a political crisis, there should be a professional there, a mediator, which there are, such as yourself. Those are the people you should go to. You should not go to Twitter and stereotype and alienate the other and spread lies and propaganda. It's just, oh, it's so frustrating, you know, because people are dying, not only in war, but in economic disparity, in lack of access to health care, lack of access to food, and lack of access to proper security and community. I mean, it's happening every day, and it's just getting worse and worse and worse, and it's very upsetting. And I just wish we could give you the power to make these people sit down and you could run them through your program, because it couldn't hurt, and I'm guessing it would help.
I'm with all of what you're saying, and I share the frustration. I don't know about the idea of forcing people together, but certainly this would be my ideal. It would be to light the fire of a couple of really well-known leaders on very different sides of an issue, let's say political or cultural leaders, to model for us these kinds of dialogues. Wouldn't that be amazing? Do you ever see that in governmental or even diplomatic circles? I mean, we had something of that, Jimmy Carter and Sadat and Begin, Palestinian and, I'm sorry, the Egyptian and Israeli leader. And, you know, a lot of what broke their very long loggerheads, they were together. I think Carter did basically lock them in a room with him for days. But what began to break the ice was something very human when, I think it was Carter, took out a photograph of his family, and they all started appreciating or admiring, you know, the babies, the kids, and it led into some discussion. I mean, you know, it sounds a little Pollyannish.
No, I don't think it's Pollyannish. I think it's, humans normally have compassion. They want to work things out. They don't want to kill. They don't want to cause harm fundamentally. But when you attack, they will get scared and attack back. And it just goes back and forth. And then the dehumanization begins and we get what we get.
Yeah. Yeah. And something shifts. I think you'll agree with this, is that something shifts when it's face to face. When, especially the one-on-one, I find particularly disarming often, if the people are willing enough to do that. But because you're just learning about so many more sides of what you saw, what you thought was just one dimension. And yes, this is true with liberals as much as conservatives often. I think liberals, and I would side more with that ideology, maybe pride ourselves on being more open-minded, and there have been studies that support that generally. But in so many cases, the vicious cycle of polarization does not know party affiliation or ideology per se. And we've seen horrible wars and violence, left and right through the centuries. The bigger point is getting at the fear. How do we help people begin to work with their fears of each other and themselves? Because what's going on, what gets activated in the self is a big part of what happens in that interaction, as you well know, with the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I do need to, however, bring up the other side, which has been brought up to me in pretty stark ways through the years too, from people who feel extremely oppressed and abused, and often people of color feeling that way. That would be the last person in the world that they would want to sit with. It would be something like sitting with their abuser. It would be like the wife, perhaps, sitting with the wife beater, or vice versa, right? Or you're sitting with somebody who's voting directly against your interests, let's say in the community. So somebody, a white person of privilege, is voting for heavier police involvement in a certain part of the inner city. Well, many of those people in the inner city are viewing the police in a very different way. And if it's just all about law and order, quote unquote, and not really a community program or interaction, that's a horror. So I can understand, that concern, that point of view. There are people who are not willing or maybe ready to enter into these kinds of conversations because of their direct experience. On the other hand, I still think that there's a very large swath of the population that would be willing to begin these kind of processes. And if there are leaders, again, who are willing to model it, that would help alleviate, I think, a lot of the divisiveness among people who follow them so closely.
Yeah, it's complicated by the current landscape of in-group, out-group behavior and the hard lines that if you even begin to talk, and especially if you empathize with the enemy, then you will be ostracized from the in-group. The in-groups will ostracize their own members who show any sign of placating the other, what they would call placating, but what we would just call like actually just trying to listen and understand. You know, unless you exhibit all the in-group behavior, which means you have to hate the other, you have to vilify the other, you have to dehumanize the other. If you do anything other than that, we will pounce on you and we will take you down. We will reject you. We will try to get you, fired at your job. We will try to discredit you. We will, we'll make death threats. I mean, it's happened to me, Dr. Steiner, like when whatever in-group I'm a part of, it perceives me as being, having betrayed the in-group. So to even engage in a conversation that involves any kind of empathy or compassion or listening, without instantly attacking them back and calling them a fascist, is potentially against dogma within a certain in-group. Now, my analysis is that behavior is because of the ongoing fighting, because of the fear, because of the hurt. It just piles up, and then eventually in-groups will just say, we're done with the out-group, and here are the rules, and anything other than this, we will not feel safe. I want to get to a couple of questions, though, because we're running out of time. And one of the questions that I had about, independent of your book, which is great, you're a clinician, right? You're still practicing San Francisco.
Yeah.
I want to know what an existential therapist would do with certain kinds of cases. Like you work from an integrative approach, but I'm wanting to know, like, what would be, if there is such a thing, an existential purist approach to the following case. So I thought about a case, a typical kind of case. We have a 35-year-old woman. She's depressed. She comes in. She's had 5 years of mild depression, not severe. She hates her job. Her marriage has been bad for 15 years. She doesn't really think about divorce, but the kids are getting older and she's quite passive in life. She feels like she's always been just pleasing everyone, and she's unhappy and she wants to change that, how would a existential therapist like yourself approach that, generally speaking?
Well, first, I'd want to build a relationship with her. So I'd want to find out more about who she is, how she's presently living. I mean, I see my work really centered on two basic questions. How is one presently living? And that usually brings up a client's battle, if you will, the part of themselves that feels tremendously oppressed or broken or dispirited.
But it's an interesting phrasing of the question. It's not just like, tell me about your life. You're saying, how are you presently living? It is existential in nature because it implies that you are active in this living, right? Because that is an existential notion. It's not, life isn't happening to you entirely, at the very least. You are participating. So how are you living this life right now? Is that, am I hearing that right?
Yeah, there's a responsibility element to it, to the question. There's also more of a here and now orientation, even if it has to do with the past. How does the past manifest in the present of how you're presently living? So there's this battle between the part of oneself that is feeling crushed and the part of oneself that is attempting in its own way to break out of that, to break on through to a new self, in a way, to a freedom, often. Freedom to pursue this relationship or this job or this project, whatever it is. So try to give the person room to really explore that. And then on the heels of that basic question is the question of, okay, so given your battle and how you're living, how are you willing to live? And that's more of the responsibility question, ability to respond to your situation. How are you willing to live? In other words, a lot of the work is about me being a sort of a passive and active mirror to the client so that they can see how they're constructing their world closer and closer up. And by active mirror, I mean sometimes sharing my own responses with the client in the service of further deepening and exploration. Passive mirror, maybe calling attention to what I'm seeing, how they're holding themselves or what they're talking about and reflecting that back. But we're kind of revisiting that battle over and over with that mirror. And ideally, they're seeing closer and closer up both what is crushing their spirit and what is attempting to break through equally, because both are getting vivified through that process. And the hope is, and I've seen it fortunately pretty frequently, that through seeing that battle close up, the person basically becomes ready to overcome that battle. They're sick and tired of staying, living in that prison. So for this woman, maybe sick and tired of feeling oppressed as a mother or a housewife, or I don't know, there seemed like a number of depressive issues that she was suffering. And I don't know what that would lead to, but I can tell you with great assurance that it will lead to something different than what she's been experiencing if she stayed with the therapeutic process enough. And she gets into that place of how are you willing to live? And I don't ask those questions explicitly necessarily. Sometimes I do, but I'm saying both implicitly and explicitly. Those are questions that run through the entire work. How are you presently living? Are you willing to live? And people are presently living on all kinds of levels, as you know. So there's the client's desire and capacity for deeper change.
Yeah.
That's really important.
Yeah, the willing part, you know, because a more common question that people would ask is, how do you want to live? But you choose the word willing to live. It's not just what you want, but also as a subset of what you want, what are you willing? Because you might want something, but you're not willing to do it. And it implies, again, this is you. You know, you could want something, but you might not be willing to do it. Or you might want something, but you might not recognize that you are the driver of that bus. You're, you know, are you willing to do this? It really gets at that notion that, because people will say, I want a better life. And then you would do a follow-up question of just like, well, are you willing to do what it takes to get there? Are you willing to actually take action internally?
Or how about if we agree to this goal for the next week?
Yeah.
Are you willing to try that out?
Yeah. And yeah, that's interesting. So if I heard this without knowing it was you or framed in an existential way, I would just say that was a flavor of core humanistic approach, not necessarily existential. You know, because when we talk about existential, they often talk about, you know, anxiety and responsibility and these kinds of things. The three or four bullet points that I will always hear and never really, I get and I appreciate, but I'm always like, well, what does that exactly look like in therapy? You know, what do we actually, existential therapists, what do they do? So hearing what you're saying, yeah, that's a very rich, person-centered, exploratory, validating, holding environment for a client to be able to really have someone listen, really have someone take the time to allow them to explore themselves without any judgment, without any expectations, and the individual with, you know, little bits of influence around like, well, are you willing to do this? What do you want to do? And what are you willing to do? What are you actually going to take into action for yourself? Up to you, of course. Am I right about that? That it is what you're talking about is pretty core humanistic and not necessarily existential?
Well, these terms get blurred easily. I mean, that's why I think there's this whole American movement of existential humanistic psychology and therapy. The two go together in many ways. You know, we could go down a rabbit hole in distinguishing between the two and the lineages of the two. I mean, traditionally, existential psychology has come out of European continental philosophy, existential philosophy, and was more philosophical in its tenor and more about philosophical exploration, whereas the humanistic folks, especially in America, brought it more of a pragmatic and maybe also an optimistic, you know, sort of can-do approach that people do have the potential to live with or acknowledge the gloom and doom that we all are under, some more than others, obviously, but also that there is a great room for possibility and for what Viktor Frankl calls tragic optimism, so that, you know, one can transcend that, feel like one is participating in something much greater than what one has identified with in the past. I think that's part of that humanistic, American humanistic movement coming out of Maslow and Rogers. The existential humanistic and the traditional existential psychological approaches really home in on doing their best to get at the primal terror that we were talking about. To help a person to in some way come to terms with that sense of helplessness and groundlessness that they experience in their dysfunction.
To face it rather than run away from it.
That's right. And not just intellectually, or not just change it behaviorally or through physiological means. Although I do believe as an integrative existential therapist that those can be helpful at different times with different people. But for many, to make fundamental shifts, I believe, like many other existential-oriented therapists, that one must encounter or face those deeper struggles with one's whole bodily being, not just part. And that means often, staying present, you know, maybe even in silence, in a kind of pregnant silence with the client as they stay present, especially to what they're feeling, what they're sensing in their bodies, what they're imaging. And I have a whole approach around that that I find helpful that I call embodied meditation. I brought that into the work I did for an APA video demonstrating this approach called existential humanistic therapy over time. So that's a place to see it in action. But the client really, in that case and in others, really got down to an area that can't be categorized in words. In other words, interpretations at that point almost become desecrations of what one is experiencing, because you can't wrap your head around some of those places. And that's why I think clients who go into those deepest wounds begin speaking in metaphors, like, I'm in a free fall, I'm drowning, I'm cut from the mothership, I'm in a black hole, bottomless pit. I mean, one needs to, in my view and in my own experience as a patient, be in that place.
As opposed to just interpreting it as, oh, this is your childhood issue that's coming up. You want to be with someone.
Yes. I mean, some of that can be useful, and I see it often as preparatory for this more pre-verbal kinesthetic or embodied staying with that great tumult that one is experiencing in the wound, so that one can, in a literal and figurative, in a figurative and literal sense, reoccupy the parts of oneself that one has blocked off and overcome that battle in many ways, anyway, achieve a much greater inner freedom to be with the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's take a short break, and when we get back, let's continue. So, since I was a teenager, and you write about it in your book as well, For Your Own Self, I have always been periodically and frequently aware of the transientness of my life and others' lives and of everything in life. And I don't know where that comes from. I don't have, you talk about how your brother died when you were young, and how I'm guessing that put transientness of life right front and center for you. For me, I didn't really have anything like that. So I don't know exactly what happened, but I've always been very much aware of it. And it comes, I guess, it's a long kind of broad issue, but it comes with it both good and bad. The bad is lying awake at night, staring into the darkness with the utter abyss of the terror of, I hold out for the possibility of an afterlife, but I can't know that, obviously. And so there's a chance, I would say, some would say a pretty good chance, that once I'm dead, it's just like, that's it. That's the end of the line. And that is terrifying to me. And I don't understand how other people aren't terrified by it as much as I am. Like, or not terrified necessarily, but to me, it ends in just kind of disappointment. Like, this is how the universe works? That sucks. I don't want that for me. I don't want that for you. I don't want that for anyone. So it's really not great. On the plus side of acknowledging this, I acknowledge the limitation of life, and I live each day to its fullest, and I will not do things that I don't want to do, because I'm not going to waste my precious time doing stupid shit like going to a party I don't want to go to, or holding on to a job for 5 years longer than I should have, or being in a relationship longer than I should have, or something. I have always lived by that principle, and I think I've greatly benefited from it. So when I present this to people, even therapists at times, they will just say, oh, death anxiety. And then they think of it like, I'm claustrophobic, or I have this phobia of germs that's unreasonable. Like, oh, I get it. You have death anxiety. Let's talk about how you can get rid of that. And I'm like, one, you can't get rid of it without, I don't know, like killing off part of your brain, I suppose. And two, I don't want to get rid of it, because this is an important... Do you ever run into that?
That is a great question and a great problem, probably the core problem for all of us. I try to take the approach of neither downplaying the specter of death nor foreclosing what that is. So you may notice in the book that I have a whole chapter where I call myself an enchanted agnostic, meaning that I don't know what happens after we die. I am horrified by it, and I have to acknowledge a bit of intrigue by that whole realm that's beyond the human as well. Now, I think both have their place. I'm right with you that I wouldn't want somebody to gloss it over with all kinds of, kind of vanilla images. Being aware of the passing nature of time and life can be extremely poignant and concentrating of our time here and now. And I guess, as you mentioned, I've been acutely aware of that since I was a very small child and my brother died. I was about 2.5 and he was 7. And I it was very much crushing in a lot of ways, but I did get the help and support eventually so that I could see other sides of my death terror, like realizing I gotta do it now. Time is passing. This will never happen again. Gotta tap in. So it has helped to focus and concentrate my life, and probably added to my drive toward productivity. Fortunately, I enjoy most of it. So it's not a labor at all. But the other side of that is, I think that point of intrigue about it or curiosity is an important element. I'll just convey this one experience of death or death anxiety that has served as a model for me. Who knows what would happen when I'm actually in that place? But Ernest Becker, the great cultural anthropologist who wrote Denial of Death, I think is a biblical work in our field, all about death anxiety, was asked by Sam Keen, the editor of Psych Today, on his deathbed. Becker was only 49. He was dying of stomach cancer. You know, you've studied death as much or more than anyone in our culture. And now that you're actually facing it, I wonder what you have to convey to our audience. And Becker said something like, well, I take solace in giving up when there's nothing left to the tremendous creative energies of the cosmos to be used for purposes we don't know. And to be used for such purposes, even if it feels like we're misused, is the consolation somehow. I find that extremely brave and extremely rich, I guess, as an approach to one's own dying. I mean, he's not even entertaining death anxiety. He's right in it. He's going to die within a week of that interview. And it seems to me he's saying, you got to grab into life, use it for all you can, giving up when there's nothing left, meaning encountering it, living it fully. And then when there's nothing left, giving oneself over to the tremendous creative energies of the cosmos to be used for purposes we don't know. And there's something, I don't know, awesome about that. Also terrifying.
Yeah. You write about in the book having looked into the darkness when you're trying to fall asleep and feeling that horror. Does it happen for you when you're laying down to fall asleep as often as it does for me?
Well, I don't know. But my experience of that was like funneled into one catastrophic night, pretty much. I described that moment where I basically had a breakdown in graduate school. Well, it was a series of events that I think reactivated my primal terror from when I was a very small child and traumatized by the death. But I was like 22 years old or 21. And I had a tremendous panic attack and feared that I was going crazy, basically. So it's like the whole cosmos poured through me. It's hard to describe, but every demon I could imagine was pouring into me that night. And I woke up literally trembling, not knowing what to do. Fortunately, a fellow graduate student who was blind, actually, helped me to find a therapist who is probably the most important healer in my life the next 9 months or so in working back through all. So I'm so thankful to that because it's helped me to limit those kinds of terrors ever since then. But that was a real dark night of the soul, so to speak, for months. And I don't know, we go through it in different ways, but you're not alone. I mean,
yeah, for me, that's the most comforting thing that I've found. There was a real breakthrough for me 10 years ago when I read a phenomenological research paper on this death anxiety or death horror, as you put it. And there were all these descriptions from people who were similar minded, and hearing them go into detail and to see the research going into detail and the themes, it suddenly just felt like, oh, I'm not alone. And somehow it just felt, and I'd known other people would have it as well, and there'd be brief descriptions, but when I read this paper 10 or 15 years ago, it really shifted for me a feeling of peace with it, essentially. The last question I have for you, Dr. Snyder, is I'm terrified of another thing, is that our field, and I don't know where our field is headed or where it's even headed, even in my time in this field over the past 25 plus years, but it seems to me that I wouldn't be surprised if in 25, 35 years in our field, humanistic psychology and existential psychology will be a thing of the past. It will be something that won't be talked about at the expense of CBT, which is great. I think you've talked about before, I watched an interview with you. You talked about how cognitive therapy is great, behavioral therapy is great. Same with me. You're integrative. I'm integrative. But there is this movement that has a variety of different factors that are contributing to it. And you write about a lot about the robotization of our psyches, which my mentor, Dr. Philip Cushman, I don't know if you know of him.
And you know Phil. He was a good friend and a fellow graduate of Saybrook University.
Oh, he's a good friend. Okay. I don't know if you know, but he recently died.
And I've got a sad place in my heart.
Yeah, he was a fellow professor with me at Antioch. His office was right next to mine, and he was also my mentor at my doctorate program. And so anyway, you know, yeah, wonderful, wonderful person. And he would often talk about this as well, that over time, the definition of the self is something that we have to hermeneutically examine. And I'm terrified of that. And I see it in my program that I teach in. I see it among colleagues. I see it in the rhetoric online. I'm terrified that existential therapy and humanistic existential therapy will just be reduced to these four bullet points. No one will really understand the depth and the meaning of these bullet points, the way it would be enacted in humanistic interaction, because it's hard to describe. It's hard to, you can describe CBT in a paragraph. You can't do that with humanistic psychology. And the way that insurance companies are paying and the way our society, I don't know. Are you scared like I am? I guess I'm asking if there's a way out of this fear for me.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I feel like a cry in the wilderness, and you may as well. But I feel it's vital that we cry, that we make our voices known for the record. That's what I feel like a lot of my work is, for the record. Maybe somebody, some humanistically oriented person, philosophically oriented person, we'll pick it up someday and say, hey, it's time to regroup here. You know, there are riches that we're overlooking, that we're not even exposed to because of our device-driven world or our device-mediated world. And we're missing a lot in not having human-to-human contact. I'm recognizing the irony of us being a machine ourselves here, but at least we are talking about these things. We're trying to address them and shift them. But this is also why I really think that we need a systemic change. This is a whole socio-political problem. I mean, the quick fix, instant result model is our political, our social system. In many ways, the capitalist system that it drives us to get things done quickly, cheaply, you know, as profit oriented as possible, which means as cheap as possible for many. So it's going to take a whole cultural change, a systemic change. And I think that's what a number of us are pressing on as well with these ideas about, for example, experiential democracy dialogues and, you know, reintroducing the importance of longer term relational psychotherapy and making it affordable and accessible. These are ways of exposing people to potentially deeper ways of thinking and of living that can provide a richer or more enriching space for us all to live in, to relate to each other, to put into our work, our sense of purpose and meaning.
Well, and actually addresses what people come in for therapy for. They want to feel better. They want to be less depressed. They want to be less anxious. They want to have better relationships. They want to have more meaning. That's really hard to do in 10 sessions of CBT.
That's right. That's right. And my problem with CBT, like you were mentioning before, and other programmatic approaches, is not that they can't be helpful. I do think they can be helpful at times with particular people. It's that we see them as the be-all and end-all so often. And certainly the more we become roboticized, as I've put it, device-oriented, the more the mechanical model for living is going to be seen as the be-all and end-all, the efficiency model of living, to the point where kids won't even know what they're missing because they've never really been exposed to some of these raw person-to-person flesh and blood kinds of encounters with ourselves and with other people.
I don't think I'd ever heard of that term before, this defining the self through efficiency. And you just said a couple sentences around that in another interview I listened to, and it really just hit me. I was like, oh my God, yeah. I mean, even in relationships, even with therapy, people will go to therapy because they will frame it as, not everyone, of course, but they'll frame it as, well, I need to be more, they won't use this phrasing, but they need to be more efficient in their emotions, or they need to be more efficient in their relationships. They need to get more done in the week. There's so much to get done, and they have to be able to cry well and effectively and get it out of the way. And then they have to have sex with their partner and get that out of the way effectively. I got to eat effectively. I've got to work effectively. I've got to parent effectively. And of course, effectively can mean a lot of different things, but I get that way myself, where I feel like every day I'm waking up and go, how can I be as productive as possible? Which is of course the capitalist model. And it's all just pumped into our heads by those who pull the strings of power, those that have all the money and the political power. And it is concerning to me, obviously. And so not only with all the things, but also with the therapy models that we as therapists within our culture, we're embedded in the culture, the therapy models that we will be attracted to and study and integrate into our work, and the kinds of things people come into therapy for. Because, you know, someone come into therapy for all the wrong reasons. You know, they want to be efficient with their emotions instead of just being a human being and being a healthy person with well-being and enriching and trying to make a positive difference in the world. And so what I'm hearing from you is you have almost resigned to, we've crested the hill in our field, that it's clear that we've moved away from humanistic psychology and existential. And so now you're at the point where you're just like, well, I just want it to be documented that I was saying something else. When and if someone in the future looks back and says, I think we made a mistake, I just want it to be on the record that I was screaming into into the abyss, saying, let's not do this?
I'm not quite saying that it's over, that we've crested the hill. I'm saying that is my concern, my worry. I do see some places, some rays of light, if you will, within our field that are reopening to the depth perspective, the experiential perspective. My hope is that they don't get co-opted into the very kind of reductionist, you know, mechanical mode that you were referring to. But I do think there is some hope because people are in great crisis and they are looking for deeper, more substantive ways to live a life that matters. I think that's our strongest argument right now.
So everyone out there, buy Dr. Snyder's new book, Life Enhancing Anxiety, Key to a Sane World. So you can buy that on Amazon. It's a good read, very easy to read book and enriching, a lot of ideas in there. And everyone, please, out there, take care of yourself. Dr. Snyder, why should everyone take care of themselves?
Well, to live with and make the best of the depth and mystery of existence.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.